would come in an offensive context, protecting the United States against a retaliatory attack by the tiny number of Russian or Chinese weapons that might survive a U.S. first strike. Lieber and Press had actually been floating these ideas for a couple of years in academic circles, but their publication in Foreign Affairs hit like a sledgehammer. The Washington Post reported that the article sent heads spinning in Russia with visions of Dr. Strangelove. Russian economist and former acting Prime Minister Yegor Gaidar wrote in the Financial Times, "The publication of these ideas in a respectable American journal has had an explosive effect. Even those Russian journalists and analysts who are not prone to hysteria or anti-Americanism took it as an outline of the official position of the U.S. administration." Putin immediately announced that Russia would spend whatever was necessary to maintain its deterrent capability. But the publication was a major blow to Putin's prestige, said Vitaly Shlykov, a strategic analyst formerly with the Soviet Military Intelligence Agency, GRU. Now he will pull out all the stops and spend whatever necessary to modernize Russia's nuclear deterrent, Shlykov predicted. Some Russian experts pointed to the fact that a new generation of nuclear missiles capable of penetrating the U.S. missile defense system was about to come online. They had been developed in response to Bush's abrogating the ABM Treaty in 2001 and included Topol-M ICBMs and, a little later, Bulava missiles for nuclear submarines. Russian experts debated the article's timing and the message the CFR was trying to convey. "Many people think it's not a coincidence that such an article was ordered by someone," explained Dmitry Suslov, an analyst with the Independent Council on Foreign and Defense Policy in Moscow. "Because it was substantially true," he said, "it had made security experts very nervous." He thought it odd that with all the nuclear powers in the world, only the United States and Russia still had arsenals pointed and primed to wipe each other out. But publication of the article meant that the situation was not about to change. "At the very least," he noted, "this article has postponed any chance of talking about removing the MAD framework from our relations with the U.S. Others thought it was designed to send a warning about Russia's growing ties with China. Viktor Mikhailov, director of the Institute of Strategic Stability and a former Russian nuclear energy minister, dismissed allegations that Russia's capabilities had deteriorated and offered an alternative explanation. "This was done during our President Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin's visit to the People's Republic of China. The Americans probably look at this drawing closer together by our two countries maliciously and malignly, but it exists and it will be developing." If that was the intention, Gaidar thought, it would backfire. If someone had wanted to provoke Russia and China into close cooperation over missile and nuclear technologies, it would be difficult to find a more skillful and elegant way of doing so, he wrote. The Bush administration scrambled to calm the tense situation. Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy, Peter Flory, released a statement in a follow-up forum in the September-October Foreign Affairs that took issue with both the article's accuracy and its interpretation. He claimed that the United States was actually weakening its first strike capability. Keith Payne, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Forces Policy from 2002 to 2003, insisted that the United States had consistently rejected developing a credible first strike capability since the days when Robert McNamara was Secretary of Defense. Payne charged angrily, "They cherry-pick and misstate information about U.S. force developments to fit the policy they have so miscast, while ignoring or dismissing U.S. force reductions and glaring deficiencies that do not fit their characterization. Their message is a gross distortion of U.S. policy, and that distortion is destabilizing U.S.-Russian relations." Alexei Arbatov, director of the Center on International Security Studies at the Institute for World Economy and International Relations of the Russian Academy of Sciences, thought that Lieber and Press were making a very important point. He acknowledged that Russian nuclear weapons were mostly Cold War relics that had outlived their usefulness and would soon be removed from service. The modern arsenal consisted of 3 or 4 new ballistic missile submarines and 100 Topol M missiles, which would suffice as a minimal deterrent, but only if kept on dangerous hair-trigger alert. In light of this growing strategic imbalance, Arbatov feared that a crisis could easily result in an accidental nuclear war. He warned, if Russia feared a U.S. first strike, Moscow might make rash moves, such as putting its forces on alert, that would provoke a U.S. attack. Lieber and Press, he concluded, are rightly concerned about that risk. Lieber and Press replied convincingly to Florian Payne, as well as to Pavel Podvig, a Stanford expert on Russia's nuclear program, who argued that Russian capabilities were far more potent than suggested. Lieber and Press conceded that the Pentagon had cut the size of the ballistic missile submarine fleet, but pointed out that the yield of SLBM warheads had more than quadrupled, and their accuracy had markedly increased. As a result, an SLBM warhead used to have a 12% chance of destroying a hardened Russian missile silo, whereas now one type of SLBM warhead had a 90% chance and the other had a 98% chance. A similar situation prevailed with the upgraded Minuteman III ICBMs. They next responded to Payne by showing that the United States had retained first-strike options in its nuclear war plans, pointing to a recently declassified 1969 document containing 5 full-scale nuclear attack options, 3 of which were preemptive. In response to Podvig, they argued that the gap in Russia's early warning system was large enough for the United States to launch SLBMs through and hit targets across Russia. Their response did nothing to calm Russians' fears, nor did U.S. plans to install a missile defense system in Eastern Europe. Russia also took sharp issue with Bush administration efforts to weaponize space. Bush appeared to be realizing the vision of the head of the U.S. Space Command, who had predicted in 1996, "We will engage terrestrial targets someday, ships, airplanes, land targets, from space. We're going to fight from space and we're going to fight into space. That's why the U.S. has development programs in directed energy and hit-to-kill mechanisms." The rest of the world united in opposition to U.S. plans to expand the realm of conflagration. In 2000, the United Nations, by a vote of 163-0, passed a resolution on the prevention of an outer space arms race, with Micronesia, Israel, and the United States abstaining. Defying world opinion, in January 2001, a commission led by Rumsfeld warned that the United States could face a space Pearl Harbor if it didn't dominate space, and recommended that the military ensure that the president will have the option to deploy weapons in space. That year, Peter Tietz, Undersecretary of the Air Force, told a space warfare symposium, "We haven't reached the point of strafing and bombing from space. Nonetheless, we are thinking about those possibilities." In 2006, UN members voted 166-1 in favor of the resolution, with only the United States opposed. At the UN Conference on Disarmament, the United States consistently thwarted efforts by Russia and China to ban weaponization. Among the more bizarre programs the Air Force was looking into was one called Rods from God, which would deploy solid tungsten cylinders, 20 or 30 feet long and 1 or 2 feet in diameter, that would be fired from satellites at tremendous speeds, easily destroying any target on Earth. Between NATO expansion, U.S. nuclear and space policies, and wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, U.S.-Russian relations took a sharp turn for the worse. The hopes for Russian-American friendship and a different world so eloquently articulated by Gorbachev had now definitively been relegated to the junk heap of history. It was as if the Bush administration were creating the nightmarishly militarized nation that Eisenhower had so poignantly warned about in 1961. During Bush's years in office, military spending more than doubled to reach $700 billion. The Pentagon had increasingly usurped the role of the State Department in foreign policy making, a process that had begun under the Kennedy administration. It also encroached upon CIA intelligence gathering and had become increasingly involved in overseas covert operations. After marginalizing the agency in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, Bush largely completed the decades-old process of destroying the nation's intelligence gathering capabilities when he appointed Congressman Porter Goss to replace George Tenet in July 2004. Goss had joined the agency as a Yale undergraduate 45 years earlier, but he had become an unbridled critic who, according to Howard Hart, denounced the agents as a bunch of dysfunctional jerks and a pack of idiots. As director, he undertook the biggest purge in the agency's history. According to Tim Weiner in his Pulitzer Prize-winning History of the CIA, the new director surrounded himself with a team of political hacks he had imported from Capitol Hill. They believed they were on a mission from the White House, or some higher power, to rid the CIA of left-wing subversives. The agency was further emasculated later that year, when Bush appointed John Negroponte to the newly created position of Director of National Intelligence, DNI. When former CIA Director Robert Gates became Secretary of Defense late in 2006, generals were ensconced as Director of the CIA, both Undersecretary and Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, Chief of the State Department's Counterterrorism Operations, and Head of CIA Covert Operations, all positions long held by civilians. Retired Admiral Mike McConnell soon replaced Negroponte as DNI. The Pentagon also owned or leased over 75% of all federal buildings, and it ran a vast, far-flung network of over 700, by some counts over 1,000, bases in some 130 countries that spanned every continent but Antarctica, plus 6,000 bases in the United States and its territories. The Department of Defense Base Structure Report for FY 2008 stated, "The Department of Defense, DOD, remains one of the world's largest landlords, with a physical plant consisting of more than 545,700 facilities, buildings, structures, and linear structures, located on more than 5,400 sites on approximately 30 million acres. Its 13 naval task forces patrolled the oceans and seas. The American Enterprise Institute called for turning this network of overseas bases into a system of frontier stockades, housing a global cavalry, which, like the cavalry of the Old West, is one part warrior and one part policeman." Douglas Fife outlined the new military posture. "We are performing the most thorough restructuring of U.S. military forces overseas since 1953, he informed the House Armed Services Committee. "We want greater flexibility for our forces, their ability to deploy powerful capabilities rapidly anywhere in the world where they are needed." Fife regretted that September 11th had made the current posture obsolete. "Much of our current posture," he testified, "still reflects the mentality and reality of the Cold War. Forward-deployed forces configured as defensive tripwire units and expected to fight near where they were based. But now those forces would be required to project power into the theaters that may be far from where they are based. The lessons of the last 15 years tell us," he elaborated, "that we often are required to conduct military operations in places that were not predicted. Our goal is to have forces deployed forward in such a way that they can quickly reach crisis spots as necessary in the future." This would require a rethinking of current basing arrangements. He noted, for example, "Our plans for our posture in Europe include lighter and more deployable ground capabilities, leading-edge air and naval power, advanced training facilities, and strengthened special operations forces, all positioned to deploy more rapidly to the Middle East and other hotspots. The administration has instituted what some experts describe as the most militarized foreign policy machine in modern history, wrote James Sterngold in the San Francisco Chronicle. The policy has involved not just resorting to military action or the threat of action, but constructing an arc of new facilities in such places as Uzbekistan, Pakistan, Qatar, and Djibouti that the Pentagon calls lily pads. They are seen not merely as a means of defending the host countries, the traditional Cold War role of such installations, but as jumping-off points for future preventive wars and military missions. The United States was not only the world's policeman, it was also the world's arms supplier, often fueling the conflicts in which it ultimately intervened on humanitarian grounds. In 2008, it signed agreements to sell $37.8 billion in arms, representing over 68% of the world total. Italy came in second at $3.7 billion. Almost $30 billion of that total went to developing nations, which purchased over 79% of their arms from the United States. It fell to none other than Zbigniew Brzezinski to accurately assess the toll taken on American democracy by Bush's disastrous war on terrorism. Brzezinski was in a good position to know, having played a similar role in stirring up Cold War fears of the Soviet Union. He wrote in March 2007 that the so-called war on terror, by deliberately creating a culture of fear, had had a pernicious impact on American democracy, on America's psyche, and on U.S. standing in the world. The damage was infinitely greater than that inflicted on 9/11. He worried that the administration was exploiting public fear to justify war with Iran, and contrasted the United States' 5 years of almost continuous national brainwashing on the subject of terror with the more muted reactions of other victims of terrorism, including Britain, Spain, Italy, Germany, and Japan. He mocked Bush's justification for his war in Iraq and his absurd claim that he has to continue waging it lest Al-Qaeda cross the Atlantic to launch a war of terror here in the United States. Bush's fear-mongering was reinforced by terror entrepreneurs, experts on terrorism, whose task is to convince the public that it faces new threats. That puts a premium on the presentation of credible scenarios of ever more horrifying acts of violence. As a result, America has become insecure and more paranoid. For proof, he pointed to Congress's ever-growing list of potential targets across the United States for would-be terrorists. He also deplored the madness of proliferating security checks, electronic billboards urging motorists to report suspicious activity, drivers in turbans, and television shows with bearded terrorists as the central villains that reinforced the sense of the unknown but lurking danger that increasingly threatened the lives of all Americans. Television and films had stereotyped Arabs, he regretted, in a manner sadly reminiscent of the Nazi anti-Semitic campaigns, opening Arab Americans to harassment and abuse. He noted the impact that the Bush administration's appalling civil rights records had had on citizens at home, and the grave damage the war on terror had done to the United States internationally. For Muslims, he wrote, the similarity between the rough treatment of Iraqi civilians by the U.S. military and of the Palestinians by the Israelis has prompted a widespread sense of hostility toward the United States in general. He singled out a recent BBC poll of 28,000 people in 27 countries that ranked Israel, Iran, and the United States as the states with the most negative influence on the world. Alas, for some, he emphasized, that is the new axis of evil. Brzezinski concluded by asking, where is the U.S. leader ready to say, enough of this hysteria, stop this paranoia, and urge that, even in the face of future terrorist attacks, the likelihood of which cannot be denied, let us show some sense. Let us be true to our traditions. As Brzezinski repeatedly made clear, terrorism was a tactic, not an ideology, and declaring war on a tactic made absolutely no sense. Meanwhile, behind the ideological veil of free market capitalism, the richest Americans continued to plunder the national wealth. Bush and Cheney did everything they could to facilitate the effort, knowing the consequences full well. Shortly before the 2000 presidential election, Bush joked with some of his wealthy followers. "This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base." Within months of taking office, Bush signed a bill cutting taxes for the wealthiest Americans. He passed additional tax cuts in 2002 and 2003. Meanwhile, federal spending rose sharply, increasing 17% in his first term alone. Under Clinton, federal spending had increased by 11% in constant dollars over two terms. By 2004, Bush had turned the $128 billion surplus he inherited into a $413 billion deficit. The New York Times reported that for Wall Street, the Bush years were the new Gilded Age. Bankers, the Times revealed, celebrated their obscene bonuses with five-figure dinners. The Government Accountability Office, GAO, reported that between 1998 and 2005, two-thirds of American corporations, at least a quarter of which had assets in excess of $250 million, paid no income taxes. These years saw the sharpest rise in income inequality in the nation's history. The 44.3% of the nation's income that went to the top 10% in 2005 exceeded the 43.8% that had gone to the top 10% in 1929, and was a far cry from the 32.6% of 1975. In 2005, the richest 3 million had as much income as the bottom 166 million, who comprised more than half of the population. The ranks of American billionaires swelled from 13 in 1985 to more than 450 in 2008. 227,000 people joined the ranks of millionaires in 2005 alone. But workers' wages barely kept pace with inflation, and 36 million were below the poverty line. Almost all the new wealth created went directly to the top 10% of the population, with most going to the top 0.1%. In 2006, the 25 top U.S. hedge fund managers earned an average of $570 million each. In 2007, their average earnings jumped to $900 million. The International Labor Organization reported that between 2003 and 2007, executive managers' pay increased by 45% in real terms, while that of the average executive grew by 15%, and that of the average worker by only 3%. In 2003, executive managers in the top 15 U.S. firms earned 300 times as much as the average American worker. By 2007, that number was up to more than 500 times. Bush cut the top tax rates on income, on capital gains, which were mostly stock profits, and on dividends, which typically fell from 39.6% to 15%. The 36% marginal tax rate on the richest Americans was the lowest it had been in over 80 years, and a far cry from the 91% under Eisenhower. But few hedge fund or private equity managers paid the 36% rate. Treating their earnings as capital gains, they paid in an average of 17%. The situation got so bad that billionaires, including Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, publicly decried the inequality gap. Buffett, the third richest man in the world, noted that he was taxed at 17.7% on his taxable income, while his secretary was taxed at 30% of hers. Estate taxes, which only the top 2% paid, had also been slashed. Meanwhile, the minimum wage stagnated at $5.15 an hour from 1997 to 2007. In 2007, at the other end of the scale, some 2 million U.S. households were worth between $10 million and $100 million, and thousands were worth more than that amount. Labor Secretary Elaine Chao was the most openly anti-labor occupant of that office in more than 100 years. She effectively dismantled the Occupational Safety and Health Administration and the Mine Safety and Health Administration. Unions were put under unprecedented scrutiny by Department of Labor agents, while employers were allowed to flout regulations with impunity. As a result, union membership plummeted to record lows, as barely 12% of the workforce was represented at the end of the Bush presidency, most of whom were government workers. Global inequality was even more extreme. A December 2006 report by economists in the United States, Canada, Great Britain, and Finland found that the richest 1% owned 40% of global wealth, and the top 10% owned 85%, while the poorest 50% struggled to survive with only 1%. Per capita wealth ranged, in 2000, from $180,837 in Japan and $143,727 in the United States to $1,100 in India and $180 in the Democratic Republic of Congo. By 2008, the net worth of the world's richest 1,100 people, its billionaires, was approximately double that of the poorest 2.5 billion people. Some analysts estimated that the world's richest 300 people had more wealth than the poorest 3 billion. Despite the wildly erroneous perceptions of the American people, U.S. foreign aid was doing little to rectify this situation. In fact, according to the OECD, U.S. development aid in 2008 totaled less than 0.2% of gross domestic product, the lowest among 22 advanced industrial nations, which averaged 0.47%. Sweden gave it more than 5 times the rate the United States did, with Luxembourg, Norway, Denmark, and the Netherlands not far behind. Even Ireland gave at more than 3 times the U.S. rate. During Bush's tenure, administration officials and their allies on Wall Street and conservative groups like the American Enterprise Institute sang the praises of unregulated financial markets, which they trusted to generate economic abundance and private fortunes. They turned a blind eye to financial shenanigans and unbridled speculation. As the national debt skyrocketed from $5.7 trillion at the end of the Clinton administration to over $10 trillion by the time Bush left office. Economic conditions declined precipitously with the downturn that began in December 2007. Income and wealth plummeted, and poverty registered a sharp increase. Harvard economist Lawrence Katz put the situation succinctly when he stated, "For the typical American family, the 2000s have been a disaster." Even before the collapse of 2008, the Bush years had produced the lowest jobs and income growth in the post-war period. By late 2009, over 40 million Americans were living in poverty. In 1988, 26% of Americans told Gallup pollsters that the country was divided between haves and have-nots, with 59% identifying themselves as haves and only 17% as have-nots. When Pew asked that same question in the summer of 2007, 48% responded that the country was so divided, with 45% considering themselves haves and 34% have-nots. The United States had become a plutocracy, with almost a quarter of income going to the top 1% and the richest 0.1% earning as much as the poorest 120 million. Former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich identified the new plutocrats. With the exception of a few entrepreneurs like Bill Gates, they're top executives of big corporations and Wall Street hedge fund managers, and private equity managers. By November 2008, it was clear to most Americans that Bush-Cheney foreign and domestic policies had been an unmitigated disaster. A CBS News, New York Times poll placed Bush's final approval rating at 22%, down from 90% following the 9/11 attack. Cheney's stood at an abysmal 13%. Americans hungered for change. They were fed up with the United States wars, tired of runaway defense spending, concerned about assaults on constitutional rights, angry over policies that favored the very wealthy, and worried about the deepening economic collapse. But few people realized how powerful the beneficiaries of the United States military-industrial complex and national security state had become, and how fiercely they would resist any challenge to their rule. They would soon find out the hard way. Chapter 14. Obama. Managing a Wounded Empire. "We are an attractive empire, the one everyone wants to join," crowed neocon Max Boot in the aftermath of 9/11. But now, after two long and disastrous wars, trillions of dollars in military spending, a network of more than 1,000 foreign military bases, torture and abuse of prisoners on several continents, assault on both international law and the U.S. Constitution, a near economic collapse, drone attacks killing alleged terrorists and civilians alike, disparities between rich and poor unheard of in an advanced industrial country, appallingly low test scores for students, government surveillance on an unprecedented scale, collapsing infrastructure, domestic uprisings on both the left and the right, and an international reputation left in tatters, the U.S. empire does not look all that attractive. George W. Bush, who canceled his 2011 speaking engagement in Switzerland to avoid massive protests and the risk of being indicted as a war criminal, and his empire-friendly advisors bear a lot of responsibility for this sorry state of affairs. They saddled Barack Obama and the American people with an incredible mess. Obama confided to one of his closest aides, "I'm inheriting a world that could blow up any minute in a half dozen ways." The country Obama inherited was indeed in shambles, but Obama took a bad situation and, in certain ways, made it worse. Swept into office on a wave of popular euphoria, he mesmerized supporters throughout the campaign with his exhilarating rhetoric, surpassing intelligence, inspiring biography, commitment to defending civil liberties, rejection of unilateralism, and strong opposition to the Iraq War, qualities that made him seem the antithesis of Bush. The election of Barack Hussein Obama, the child of a black Kenyan father and a white Kansan mother, who was raised in Indonesia as well as Hawaii, and went on to graduate from Columbia and become president of the Harvard Law Review, felt like a kind of expiation for the sins of a nation whose reputation had been sullied, as we have shown throughout this book, by racism, imperialism, militarism, nuclearism, environmental degradation, and unbridled avarice. The suffering caused by misguided U.S. policies had been immense. For many, Obama's election offered redemption. It attested to the other side of America and its place in history, a side marked by idealism, egalitarianism, constitutionalism, republicanism, humanism, environmentalism, and the embrace of freedom and democracy as universal principles. Progressives hoped Obama would become the heir to a tradition represented by Franklin Roosevelt and Henry Wallace, and by the post-Cuban Missile Crisis, John F. Kennedy. Yet, rather than repudiating the policies of Bush and his predecessors, Obama has perpetuated them. Rather than diminishing the influence of Wall Street and the major corporations in U.S. life, Obama has given them latitude to continue most of their predatory practices. Rather than restoring the civil liberties that Bush had eviscerated and limiting the executive powers that Bush usurped after 9/11. Obama, with few exceptions, has tightened the grip of the domestic security surveillance apparatus, stifling civil liberties and the right to dissent. In the brilliant 1939 film, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, director Frank Capra spends the first 11 minutes exposing a nefarious web of power, intrigue, and clandestine deal-making to reveal the hidden world that the naive and idealistic Jefferson Smith will encounter when he tries to change the ways of Washington. Barack Obama would confront a similar nest of entrenched interests, but Obama was much more savvy and, apparently, more cynical than Smith. By knowingly surrounding himself with establishment insiders as domestic and foreign policy advisors, he preemptively closed the door on the kind of bold innovations and breaks with the past that his campaign had promised. Having betrayed his earlier promises and become the first presidential candidate to turn down public campaign financing in the general election, Obama turned to Wall Street funders with deep pockets, like Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, Skadden Arps, and Morgan Stanley. Also high on the list of Obama contributors were General Electric and other defense contractors, and the pharmaceuticals industry, Big Pharma, reversed years of supporting Republicans, contributing more than three times as much to Obama as to McCain. Obama's grassroots supporters largely overlooked these disturbing facts. Progressives projected onto him their own hopes and expectations. Conservatives, their worst fears. Both were mistaken. He ran a centrist campaign, advancing safely pragmatic policy initiatives. He consistently championed the middle class, the working class and the poor, black, Hispanic, Asian, Native American, and white, seemed an afterthought as Obama battled Hillary Clinton and then John McCain. Instead of seizing the opportunity to explain how the decline of manufacturing and other structural factors at the heart of a dysfunctional corporate and Wall Street-dominated system had exacerbated the problems for all poor people, and especially African Americans, he hectored poor blacks for not taking more personal responsibility. He positioned himself to the left of Clinton by trumpeting his opposition to the Iraq War, which she had voted to support, but to the right of George Bush on Afghanistan, a position his supporters conveniently ignored. And his Senate vote for the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which gave legal immunity to telecommunications companies complicit in Bush's wiretapping, should have signaled that he might be unwilling to relinquish some of the powers that Bush and Cheney had appropriated. The biggest winner under Obama was Wall Street. After wrecking the economy with speculative innovations, including credit default swaps and collateralized debt obligations, bankers came begging for bailouts. Not surprisingly, Obama's economic advisors, almost all disciples of Bill Clinton's Treasury Secretary, Robert Rubin, were more than happy to assist with a $700 billion financial bailout program. Rubin, who had been systematically cultivating Obama since 2005, had co-chaired Goldman Sachs prior to his stint at Treasury, where he had masterminded two of the policies that helped precipitate the financial crisis his protégés would now handle: the deregulation of the derivatives market and the 1999 repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which had separated investment banking from commercial banking. Having done Wall Street's dirty work at Treasury, he was rewarded with a top job at Citigroup, where he received $126 million over the next 8 years. The New York Times reported in late November 2008, as Barack Obama fills out his economic team, a virtual Rubin constellation is taking shape. Rubin's Treasury Chief of Staff and fellow Citigroup exec Michael Froman was in charge of putting this team together. The two top positions went to Rubin protégés Timothy Geithner, the New York Fed chief, whom Obama named as Treasury Secretary, and Lawrence Summers, whom he named Senior White House Economic Advisor. Geithner had worked under Rubin at Treasury, and Summers had been Treasury Secretary at the time Glass-Steagall was repealed. Like Rubin's, Summers, an avowed deregulator, also had cashed in on his service to Wall Street, earning $5.2 million working one day a week for the D.E. Shaw Hedge Fund in 2008, while raking in another $2.7 million in speaking fees, much coming from Wall Street firms. Goldman Sachs paid him $135,000 for one speech alone, which investigative journalist Glenn Greenwald aptly called an advanced bribe. In light of how much Wall Street was going to profit from the Geithner-Summers stewardship of the economy, Goldman Sachs and the other banksters got off cheap. Obama tapped Rubin protege Peter Orszag as budget director. According to the Times, Geithner, Summers, and Orszag have all been followers of the economic formula that came to be called Rubinomics. Balanced budgets, free trade, and financial deregulation. The lower echelons of economic decision-making were also populated by Rubin allies. The glaring exceptions were Christine Romer, chair of the Council of Economic Advisers, and Jared Bernstein, Biden's chief economic policy advisor. The two of them fought unsuccessfully during their brief tenures against some of the Rubinites' neoliberal initiatives. Former Democratic strategist David Sirota aptly identified the ways Rubin's people would mold Obama's economic strategy. Bob Rubin, these guys, they're classic limousine liberals. These are basically people who have made shitloads of money in the speculative economy, but they want to call themselves good Democrats because they're willing to give a little more to the poor. That's the model for this Democratic Party. Let the rich do their thing, but give a fraction more to everyone else. On November 23rd, 2008, the Bush administration announced a potential $306 billion bailout of Citigroup, which was facing collapse. Citigroup had recently received $25 billion under the Troubled Asset Relief Plan, which provided a massive bailout to the financial sector. The Times made clear that Geithner played a crucial role in the negotiations, and that Bush's Treasury Secretary, Henry Paulson, had worked very closely with Obama's transition team. Wall Street was so exuberant over the deal that the Dow posted its biggest two-day jump in over 20 years, and Citigroup's stock, which had tumbled in price from $30 to $3.77 in the past year, shot up 66% in one day. If you had any doubts at all about the primacy of Wall Street over Main Street, former Labor Secretary Robert Reich exclaimed, "Your doubts should be laid to rest." Abundant proof would be forthcoming. The Washington Post reported in early April 2009 that the Treasury Department was bending the law and defying the will of Congress to avoid limiting executive pay. The Obama administration is engineering its new bailout initiatives in a way that it believes will allow firms benefiting from the programs to avoid restrictions imposed by Congress, including limits on lavish executive pay, according to government officials. University of Texas economist James Galbraith lambasted Obama for meekly submitting to the bankers' demands, as if there were no other way to solve the crisis. One cannot defend the actions of Team Obama on taking office. Law, policy, and politics all pointed in one direction: turn the systematically dangerous banks over to Sheila Bair and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Insure the depositors. Replace the management. Fire the lobbyists. Audit the books. Prosecute the frauds. And restructure and downsize the institutions. The financial system would have been cleaned up, and the big bankers would have been beaten as a political force. Team Obama did none of these things. Instead, they announced stress tests, plainly designed so as to obscure the bank's true condition. They pressured the Federal Accounting Standards Board to permit the banks to ignore the market value of their toxic assets. Management stayed in place. They prosecuted no one. The Fed cut the cost of funds to zero. The president justified all this by repeating many times that the goal of policy was to get credit flowing again. The banks threw a party. Reported profits soared, as did bonuses. With free funds, the banks could make money with no risk by lending back to the Treasury. They could boom the stock market. They could make a mint on proprietary trading. Their losses on mortgages were concealed. Former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker advised Obama to take strong action. "Right now," he said, "when you have your chance and their breasts are bared, you need to put a spear through the heart of all these guys on Wall Street that for years have been mostly debt merchants." But rather than stand up to Wall Street, Obama prostrated himself before the CEOs of the 13 largest banks in March 2009, telling them, "I want to help. I'm not out there to go after you. I'm protecting you. But if I'm going to shield you from public and congressional anger, you have to give me something to work with on these issues of compensation." The bankers paid lip service to voluntary restraint and then proceeded with record bonuses. Thus, unlike the Europeans who limited bankers' compensation, the Obama administration did not even limit compensation to those whose companies were saved by government bailouts. Obscene profits ensued. The Wall Street Journal reported that total compensation and benefits at Wall Street banks, investment banks, hedge funds, money management firms, and securities exchanges reached record levels of $128 billion in 2009 and $135 billion in 2010. The greatest beneficiaries were the 25 top hedge fund managers, whose average earnings jumped from a paltry $570 million in 2006 to a more respectable $1 billion in 2009. In 2010, one New York hedge fund manager, John Paulson, pulled in $4.9 billion. Journalist Ron Suskind later reported that a more complicated internal negotiation had actually occurred behind the scenes, in which Obama agreed with Romer and others that a fundamental restructuring of the banks was necessary, beginning with Citigroup. It was Geithner and Rahm Emanuel who sabotaged this effort. Geithner, Suskind contended, simply refused to come up with the plan that Obama had asked for, and eventually convinced the president to go along with his own Wall Street-friendly approach. Emanuel, who had earned over $18 million in 2.5 years, working for the investment banking firm Wasserstein Perella after leaving the Clinton White House in 1999, insisted they all go along with Geithner. Obama rolled over without a fight. The financial crisis that began in 2008 did nothing to stanch the corporate bleeding of the middle and working classes. Average total compensation for CEOs of Standard & Poor's 500 index companies rose 23% in 2010 to $11.4 million. CEO pay, which equaled 343 times that of the median worker in 2010, had risen more than eightfold since 1980, when it stood at a mere 42 times as much. By comparison, CEOs in other industrial countries earned far less. British and Canadian CEOs earned 22 times as much as the average British and Canadian worker, and Japanese only 11. Discovery Communications CEO David Zaslav was among those who cashed in. His pay jumped from $7.9 million in 2008 to $11.7 million in 2009 to $42.6 million in 2010. The rest of the workforce was left largely to fend for itself. Obama's economic stimulus program was only about half the $1.2 trillion advocated by Christine Romer, whose recommendation was left off the options submitted by Summers. The economic recovery of the early Obama years was not only weak in terms of generating new jobs, its benefits went entirely to the wealthiest Americans. Economist Andrew Sum and his group of researchers at Northeastern University discovered that from the second quarter of 2009 through the first quarter of 2011, national income grew by $505 billion. Pre-tax corporate profits grew by $465 billion. Wages and salaries, however, declined by a sobering $22 billion. In the 9 months after hitting the nadir of the recession in the second quarter of 2009, they found corporate profits accounted for 85% of the increase in profits and wages. For the same recovery period following the 1981 to 1982 recession, only 10% had gone to corporate profits. In 2010, 93% of income growth went to the top 1% of households, leaving a scant 7% for the other 99% to divide up. The top 0.01%, some 15,000 families, did even better, absconding with a stunning 37% of new earnings. Meanwhile, benefits continued to tumble. A 2010 survey found that over the previous year, employee health insurance premiums had increased 13.7%, while employer contributions fell by 0.9%. What Chris Hedges termed the corporate rape of America had been underway for decades. While executive pay skyrocketed, pay for the average non-supervisory worker, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, had fallen more than 10% since the 1970s. The Congressional Budget Office estimated that between 1979 and 2005, income of the top 1% jumped 480%. By 2007, the top 1% was receiving 25% of national income and owned almost 40% of American wealth. With unions representing only 7% of the private workforce in 2007, real wages, adjusted for inflation, were actually lower than they had been 30 years earlier. In 2007, the bottom 80% owned only 15% of all wealth. Overall, by 2011, the Economic Policy Institute reported the richest 1% had more wealth than the bottom 90%. Families had, for the most part, managed to maintain standards of living since the 1970s by expanding female participation in the workforce. Women with young children working outside the home jumped from 24% in 1966 to 60% in the late 1990s, sharply increasing the number of hours worked. 100 more hours per year for the typical male worker and 200 more for the typical female over two decades earlier. And borrowing at inordinate and ultimately unsustainable rates, squeezing $2.3 trillion from homes between 2002 and 2007. A stunning measure of how far the United States had fallen came from the October 2011 Bertelsmann Stiftung Foundation report, Social Justice in the OECD, How Do the Member States Compare?, which ranked the United States 27th out of the 31 OECD nations, only beating Greece, Chile, Mexico, and Turkey. The report measured many factors, including poverty prevention, poverty rates for children and senior citizens, income inequality, expenditures on pre-primary education, health care, and other key metrics. The United States came in 29th in overall poverty rate and 28th in child poverty and income inequality. Columbia University's National Center for Children in Poverty reported that 42% of children lived in low-income families, half of them below the poverty line. The Associated Press reported in December 2011 that almost half of all Americans were either in poverty or subsisting on low incomes. The Census Bureau reported that in 2010, 46.2 million Americans were below the poverty line, which was the highest number since it began publishing those figures 52 years earlier. Not only were more Americans falling into poverty, fewer and fewer were able to escape. Mobility studies shattered the myth that the United States was a society with fluid class lines and easy upward mobility. In fact, the United States, with its porous social safety net, failing schools, and low percentage of unionized workers, had considerably less social mobility than any other advanced industrial society. These disparities had so infuriated Americans who were struggling to afford health care and mortgage payments while feeding their families, that Congress reluctantly acted, passing the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act in 2010. The act required corporate executives of publicly traded companies to submit their pay to shareholders for non-binding approval. Among those who railed against efforts to curb corporate pay was Countrywide Financial CEO Angelo Mozzillo, who pulled in more than $470 million in cash, plus proceeds from stock sales, during the 5 years before the effects of his untrammeled greed and illegal dealings helped bring down the housing market. Mozilo denounced the left-wing press and the envious leaders of unions for pressuring corporate boards and accused them of driving entrepreneurship out of the public sector. The Dodd-Frank Act, though a step in the right direction, did little to correct the underlying problems that caused the collapse, failing to address the incentive structures that encouraged risky behavior, or to reverse the dynamics that allowed banks to grow to the size where they were too big to fail. As William Isaac, former chairman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, acknowledged in Forbes magazine, the bill would not have prevented the recent financial crisis, and it will not prevent the next one. In truth, Isaac wrote, the bill does almost nothing to change a dysfunctional regulatory system that drove three very serious banking crises in the past 40 years. Washington Post financial staff writer Stephen Pearlstein was stunned that Obama could not give voice to this populist outrage and constructively channel this public anger over Wall Street and Geithner's let-them-eat-stuffing attitude. For Pearlstein, a telling moment came in November 2009 when Geithner gave a back of the hand to the idea of a global tax on financial transactions as a way of raising money for economic stabilization while also discouraging high-volume, short-term speculation. If Obama really cared about the people instead of those who had plundered the economy, Pearlstein wrote, he could instruct the Justice Department to launch an antitrust inquiry into excessive Wall Street profits, pressure Congress to close the tax loophole, allowing hedge fund and private equity fund managers to pay lower taxes than their secretaries, and push the Group of 20 to put the transaction tax back on the agenda. Pearlstein wondered, whose side is Obama on? The question became more poignant as the 2012 elections approached. Anger over the economy had boiled over. Occupy Wall Street and allied protesters gathered in towns and cities across the nation in a grassroots uprising of a sort not seen since the 1930s. Obama walked a fine line, trying to signal both the anti-Wall Street protesters and the Wall Street tycoons, whom the protesters reviled, that he was with them. In June 2011, the New York Times reported that Obama had offended Wall Street's high rollers by calling them fat cats and criticizing their bonuses, and by having the audacity to propose any curbs at all on their rapaciousness. Now, according to the Times, Obama and his top aides, looking for Wall Street backing in his reelection bid, were trying to salve the bankers' wounded feelings. Franklin Roosevelt had compared ungrateful capitalists to the drowning old man who berates his rescuer for not saving his hat. Obama came before them hat in hand and begged forgiveness. Unlike Roosevelt, who had made enemies of Wall Street financiers by implementing large-scale government job creation and sweeping regulatory reform, Obama not only privileged those Wall Street insiders over the working masses, he apologized for having hurt their feelings. Obama also paid debts to other corporate donors. Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz noted, when pharmaceutical companies receive a $1 trillion gift through legislation prohibiting the government, the largest buyer of drugs, from bargaining over price, it should not come as a cause for wonder. It should not make jaws drop that a tax bill cannot emerge from Congress unless big tax cuts are put in place for the wealthy. Given the power of the top 1%, this is the way you would expect the system to work. Stiglitz cited the response from banker Charles Keating, who was brought low by the 1980s savings and loan crisis. When asked by a congressional committee whether the $1.5 million he had contributed to elected officials could buy influence, he answered, I certainly hope so. The Supreme Court decision in the 2010 Citizens United case, which removed limits on corporate campaign spending, ensured that the influence of corporate and banking interests would mushroom. Obama's failure to articulate a progressive vision was also apparent in the fight over health reform, which was to have been his signature initiative. Obama decided early on that he would avoid a fight with the health insurance and pharmaceutical industries, which not only had contributed heavily to his campaign, but had played a major role in defeating Clinton's reform efforts. To win their support, he capitulated to demands that the legislation exclude core Democratic initiatives, like drug reimportation and bulk price negotiations. He also took the single-payer issue off the table, although he admitted that a single-payer system represented the best option for providing affordable care for all, as most developed countries had long proven. Rather than leading the reform effort himself, he asked Congress to come up with the details. He further placated the health insurance industry by removing the public option and Medicare expansion, despite the fact that both received lopsided public support. The medical industry did the rest. The massive effort to eliminate provisions that might reduce corporate profits was galvanized by 3,300 lobbyists, representing more than 1,500 organizations, triple the number registered to lobby on defense. Fighting to shape policies that could affect 17% of the economy, the lobbyists, who outnumbered members of Congress 6-1, spent $263.4 million in the first 6 months of 2009 alone. The resulting legislation expanded coverage for uninsured Americans, but did so in a way that was a windfall for the insurance companies. The White House blamed congressional centrists like Joe Lieberman for forcing it to accept compromises that were anathema to most Democrats. Senator Russell Feingold, a strong supporter of the public option, wasn't buying these excuses. This bill appears to be legislation that the president wanted in the first place, so I don't think focusing it on Lieberman really hits the truth, Feingold said. Obama's bungled health care reform effort, marked by the inability to even refute Republican charges of death panels, was so unpopular that it became an albatross around the necks of Democrats in the 2010 election. As Robert Kuttner noted, this battle should have been the president and the people versus the interests. Instead, more and more voters concluded that it was the president and the interests versus the people. And the Democrats paid for that widely perceived sellout. Budget battles followed the same script. Obama continued to strive for bipartisanship with opponents who were not only out to defeat him, but to discredit any notion that government was at all capable of solving social problems. As Washington Post columnist Harold Meyerson stated in April 2011, if it does nothing else, the budget that House Republicans unveiled provides the first real Republican program for the 21st century, and it is this: repeal the 20th century. Yet the final deal that Obama struck with the Republicans was actually worse than the Republicans' starting position. Not only extending the Bush tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, but slashing desperately needed social programs for the most vulnerable. Bush had temporarily instituted the tax cuts a decade earlier, knowing full well that they were never intended to expire. Dan Bartlett, Bush's former spokesman, admitted, "We knew that politically, once you get it into law, it becomes almost impossible to remove it. That's not a bad legacy. The fact that we were able to lay the trap does feel pretty good, to tell you the truth." The fact that the Obama-led Democrats walked blithely into the trap felt less good for the American public, which overwhelmingly opposed extending the tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans at a time of prodigious budget deficits. Nobel Prize-winning Princeton economist Paul Krugman bemoaned the loss of Obama, the inspirational figure, and wondered, who is this bland, timid guy who doesn't seem to stand for anything in particular? He described Obama's approach to bargaining with the Republicans as starting by negotiating with himself, making preemptive concessions, then pursue a second round of negotiation with the GOP, leading to further concessions. Krugman criticized Obama for failing to challenge the new consensus, which he characterized as a philosophy that says the poor must accept big cuts in Medicaid and food stamps, the middle class must accept big cuts in Medicare, actually dismantling of the whole program, and corporations and the rich must accept big cuts in the taxes they have to pay. Shared sacrifice. Rather than heed such criticism, Obama tacked further to the right. First, He selected William Daley, a former J.P. Morgan Chase executive, as his chief of staff to replace Emanuel. Then, adding insult to injury, he chose GE chairman and CEO Jeffrey Immelt as chair of the President's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness, making him Obama's chief outside economic advisor. Obama could not have sent a clearer signal on where he stood. In 2010, GE made over $14.2 billion in profits, but paid no federal taxes. In fact, GE actually received a $3.2 billion tax credit. The company had also received $16.1 billion from the Federal Reserve during the 2008 financial crisis. Obama's selection of Immelt as his chief advisor on job creation came at a time when GE was being lambasted for outsourcing jobs, as well as for cutting health and retirement benefits for new employees. For so effectively privileging private greed over social responsibility, Immelt, an old employee, saw his total compensation jump from $9.89 million in 2009 to $21.4 million in 2010, a raise of well over 100%. In case Wall Street didn't get a clear enough message from Immelt's appointment,